Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bunker Daily. It's been a dramatic few days in Belarus, the country often described as Europe's last dictatorship. Presidential elections were held last Sunday, with Alexander Lukashenko claiming a landslide victory again in his bid to serve a sixth term. As usual, the election was declared neither free nor fair, but this time mass protests broke out after the result was declared. And they're continuing, even as his opponent Svetlana Tsikhanouska has been forced to flee the country. With me to explain what's happening in Belarus is Andrew Wilson, professor in Ukrainian studies at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies, senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of books including Belarus, the Last European Dictatorship. Hello, Andrew. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
You say you wrote this back in 2011 when he was probably merely in his fourth term. Can you start by telling us a little bit about Lukashenko and how he's managed to stay in power for so long?
Well, ironically, he won one free and fair election back in 1994 in the sort of turbulent post-Soviet years. He was actually standing against the then post-communist establishment. He ran a sort of populist anti-corruption campaign, talked about restoring Soviet values and the Soviet welfare system. In the noughties, he was kind of able to do some of that, largely with money from Russia, cheap oil and gas. Yes. There used to be a joke or even a boast that he might have won those elections, subsequent elections, if he'd allowed them to be free and fair. He won about 30-40% of the vote and exaggerated the size of his victory. That's why it's different this time, because he doesn't have that baseline of support anymore, and this was just blatant theft.
Is it possible to sort of know or to estimate what the real result would be? You know, what is his real popularity versus his opponents?
Well, it was Condoleezza Rice's cliche about him being the last dictator in Europe. In the old days, he used to allow opinion poll guys to run surveys, but he kicked them out 3 or 4 years ago because his ratings were falling and honest sociology was a bit embarrassing. What we do have is some slight cracks in his machine, because one or two polling stations published the real results, which are basically the reverse, right. More like 70-30, 70 in favour of the opposition lady. In fact, there's one recording on YouTube of one head of a polling station saying, just swap them, just change the names on the piles from Lukashenko's pile to her pile. So there is some evidence that, you know, he lost overwhelmingly.
I mean, so is it that crude? Because when you talk about elections being rigged, you often talk about, you know, sort of voter suppression and ballot stuffing. And there's lots of different intimidation, lots of mechanisms. Is this simply that they count the votes, but then they just change the numbers at the last minute? I mean, how do they rig elections in Belarus?
A good question. I'm having a slightly strange, very academic discussion with colleagues about why Lukashenko hasn't been smarter in how he fixes this particular election. Traditionally, he did two things, neither of which were at all sophisticated. Early voting, which basically meant they voted under supervision and under pressure. Students, workforces, people in hospitals, that kind of thing. And secondly, not counting the vote, really. The counting process has always been completely non-transparent. There's no summation of individual results, no sort of plausible paper trail. And the YouTube thing that I just referred to, you know, tells you how it works. You know, this is just manual interference with the vote count. And then you've had brutal police repression. You haven't had the creation of artificial support groups or counter demonstrators that you sometimes see in countries like Russia. It's just the police versus demonstrators. He hasn't done anything clever. I suppose dictators can be clever and stupid, and this time around he's been pretty stupid.
Well, I mean, in the kind of the sort of pantheon of dictators and autocrats, obviously there's a lot of different kinds. There's the rather sort of bland but ruthless kind of functionary that rose to the top, and then there's the sort of ranting demagogue who likes building lots of statues of themselves. What sort of character is he, and what kind of a country does it run? Like, how oppressive is it? Are there any other countries? So I think a lot of people don't know that much about Belarus, and perhaps wonder, you know, are there other countries that it could be compared to, the particular nature of his regime?
Well, his image is a pig farmer dictator. Right. That was one of his jobs before he went into politics. He managed a collective farm. So he sort of originally ran as a kind of down-to-earth populist, no-nonsense, common guy. One of his nicknames is Batka, which means father, but a sort of benevolent patron. And in the noughties, you know, he was able to sort of keep factories open, keep wages reasonably high, all on Russian subsidies, cheap oil and gas. No real statues. He has sort of allowed his family, his sons, to get more and more power in recent years. So he did present himself as not corrupt, not allowing oligarchy to take over the country as it has in Russia. But after 26 years, his sort of that formula has gone a bit stale, and there are some signs of corruption around him and in his family. So part of his problem is the kind of breakdown of that kind of old image, or, you know, people seeing through it increasingly. The old act wearing a bit thin.
So is that why, like you said, apart from the 1994 one, none of the elections have been free and fair. They haven't seen protests like this. So is it just that the, his popularity has genuinely fallen? Or does it have anything to do with the response to COVID-19 or sort of other factors that make this year different?
Well, it is important that all previous elections have been fixed. And there have been small-scale protests, most notably in 2006 elections, 2010. What's different this time is added factors. The economy hasn't been doing very well. So the interesting thing about this election, before the interesting candidates were kicked out, is that you had Tsikhanouskaya, who is kind of representing poorer regional Belarus, and it's his wife who ended up standing in his place. And two other candidates who represented the other side of the coin, the kind of new private economy, the IT sector in particular. Some of you might know some of these firms, actually. Some of them have world-famous products. One of them is Grammarly, actually, that annoying advert that appears on YouTube all the time. So that IT sector is about 7-8% of the economy and dynamic and wants more freedom. And one of the candidates had been head of this IT park in Minsk. So you had an economy increasingly split in two, and you had a candidate for each, and neither of them was Lukashenko, which is why you have this quite dynamic anti-campaign against him, even before the vote was rigged.
And has COVID-19 been a big factor in the country?
Logical next question, yeah, because that has further eroded his sort of traditional support base. Because as we know, it affects vulnerable people, poorer people more. So by ignoring it, basically, those kind of people have suffered more. Plus health workers have suffered, and he's sort of downplayed the thing. And, of course, he ends up getting it, which is a delicious irony, like Bolsonaro, but, you know, symbolic of the neglect. And he was, initially, he refused to admit that he'd got it, but he was sort of sweating heavily and wearing a catheter in public on his wrist. So it became common knowledge that he'd got it. And that was symptomatic, if you like, of neglect of ordinary folk.
He's obviously doing some of those, you know, strongman response to the protests in terms of, you know, the rubber bullets and tear gas and choking off most of the country's internet in order to sort of thwart protests. I mean, it's hard to predict these things, but I mean, do you think he can just sort of crack down on the protests, reject criticism, insist on the numbers and stay in control? Or is there something kind of the sort of terminally wounded about him now?
He has been funding his internal police. They are well drilled. They are numerous. They're pretty brutal. One thing I like to show in class is when we talk about protest and revolution is what happened in Georgia in 2003 when you had a fixed election, similar protest, the crowd march on parliament, and the police opened the door to the protesters. And the punchline is, well, that's what happens when you don't pay your police. Lukashenko has paid his police, and he's got a lot of coercive capacity. Then it comes down to collective action, how brave the protesters are, how long they stick it out. I mean, there comes a tipping point eventually when people think, well, that's it. He's done everything he can do, so we will win. But I don't think the protesters are in that situation yet, confident that they will prevail. At the moment, the police force is being pretty brutal, and sadly, that sometimes works.
Were you an expert on Ukraine? You know, are there major similarities to what happened in Ukraine in 2004 and then again in 2014? Are there things that protesters could learn from that?
Well, the big difference with Ukraine is what you just said, that there were two would-be revolutions in Ukraine, the so-called Orange Revolution 2004, then the what's called the Revolution of Dignity 2014, and one fed the other. People learned how to do things differently the second time. They were more determined to get things right the second time. The protests were literally in the same place, in the centre of Kiev. Whereas this is number one in Belarus, really, although we did talk about the protests 3 years ago. So there isn't really a tradition to build on. There's no networks or parties or whatever organising any of this. It's all leaderless protest. Parallels with the rest of the world? The obvious thing is social media. Again, so-called smart dictatorships, Russia or whatever, are very good at using social media to their advantage and disabling opposition movements or attempts at organization via social media. But here you had the government dominating traditional media and really ceding social media to these better organized groups. And that's one reason why initial protests were so impressive and why the government shut everything down on Sunday, the day of the election.
And how important is Tsikhanouskaya? You mentioned sort of leaderless, and at the moment she's obviously, I think she's in Lithuania. How important a figure is she, considering also, of course, she was originally wasn't planning to run, you know, she had to sort of step in. Is it sort of almost happening with or without her?
Well, the feminization of the campaign was really interesting. She stepped in for her husband and then campaigned with two other women, the wife of one of the other excluded candidates and the campaign manager of one of the other excluded candidates. And this was much mocked by the reliably sexist and anti-Diluvian Lukashenko. And he underestimated them, I think. So the feminization of the campaign was very important and became a campaign resource. And their message was positive and simple. No real politics, because there's nothing really to promise. Tsikhanouskaya's campaign was basically, let's have an election, i.e. not this one, but if she won, she would organise a proper competitive one. So a very simple message, and it was all wrapped up in positive stuff. And the campaign theme song, was a very nostalgic song from the 80s by the Soviet band Kino, which means cinema. Changes. So this is very popular in the Gorbachev era when people wanted change back then. So they were kind of replaying that, reusing that. So very simple, very warm, very positive, very patriotic. All good stuff.
Well, finally, Nigel Gould Davis, the former British ambassador to Belarus, described the protests as the last phase of a great reordering of European politics that began in 1989. Now, it seems almost like that phase was 30 years ago. That we were in a completely different phase. And now apparently we're talking, you know, obviously we're seeing sort of autocracies rising in you know, Poland and Hungary, and almost the kind of the whole story you get in that sort of recent Anne Applebaum book is how this sort of reordering of European politics went wrong and is now producing these sort of right-wing autocracies. So it just seemed to me such a historical sort of glitch that sort of Belarus might finally be achieving where a lot of these other countries achieved 20, 30 years ago and have since sort of lost. So would you agree with that sort of analysis, that this is sort of something, just a very, very long delayed shift?
Well, pick your metaphor. I mean, people in Belarus do talk about catching up, missed opportunity, what should have happened in the late 80s, 90s, but didn't. They didn't build a democracy, although they did have a sort of chaotic semi-democracy, 1991 to 94. They didn't really build an independent nation. They stayed close to Russia. And in some senses, yeah, that's delay action stuff that's happening now. And it's always great to see the birth of a nation. Another thing that Lukashenko's lost control of is that many of the protesters have been using the national flag, the red and white flag, which was historically part of the national movement. He preferred a kind of neo-Soviet version of Belarusian identity and flag and colours and national anthem, etc. So he banned all of these old symbols, which had briefly been used when the country was first nominally independent after 1991. So people are using it as a kind of symbol of real independence, which they won't get as long as Lukashenko is still around. But, you know, that kind of attempted birth of a nation is marvellous. It's the kind of thing that we think of happens in 1848 or whenever. To some extent, it's happening now, and that's out of sync with trends in some neighbouring states. You know, Poland, Hungary, you have this right-wing Catholic nationalism in Poland's case. Belarus could be moving in another direction, so he's out of sync with the rest, yeah.
That's some reason for optimism. Thanks so much for joining me, Professor Andrew Wilson.
You're welcome.
The Bunker Daily comes out every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday with a full-length weekly episode every Wednesday. Thanks for listening. Take care. We'll see you next time.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Dorian Linsky. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold. And audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.